Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Darwin is entering the
conversation. I hardly knew him.
Yeah. Is entering the conversation again, though. We have talked about Darwin in the past because there's a lot of stuff that people don't know. We think of Origin of the Species and we stop there in school. What is this? Why are we talking about Darwin? This is Ridiculous History. Thank you for coming through. I am not Darwin. You're not Darwin. My name is Ben.
My name is Nolan. I immediately regret my joke because I'm on like East Coast brain still. We're still on the West Coast, and we've been staying up quite late, even by West Coast standards, so it's been mega, mega late by East Coast standards, and we've had a bit of a whirlwind experience, but it's kind of been fun. I'm leaning into the punchiness, but Darwin, I hardly knew him. That doesn't even make sense.
I thought it had an internal logic.
It was the phonemes of it that kind of triggered my brain to do a thing that just didn't work out. But I'm owning up to it. I'm Noel. Did I say that already?
Yeah. I'm glad you did. Either way.
People might have been confused.
You're Noel.
Like, who is this fool? Oh, it's Noel. It's fine.
You're Noel. I'm Ben. We are joined in spirit, as always, with our super producer, Casey Pegram. God only knows where we'd be without him.
Is that a Beach Boys reference?
A little bit. LaBouche is a big fan of the Beach Boys, right?
They're fantastic.
The French love the Beach Boys.
Do they?
I don't know.
They probably do. Look, the French have notoriously good taste.
I'm right there with you. I slept like maybe an hour before this. But we are also joined with our returning guest super producer, Daniel Goodman. How's it going, man?
It's going great. Ready for another episode of fun.
Oh, gosh. You're the sweetest guy.
I know, right? And he's got, like, these great food recommendations, you know?
I didn't get any food recs.
You got to ask.
We can talk after podcast.
Okay, sounds good. That sounds good. I'm ready for it. I went to a place called the Fleet-Footed Goose. No, it wasn't that. It was just the Running Goose. See? I added too many words to it. You been to the Running Goose?
I have not. Where's that at?
It's right around here. It's on the front end of the block. I want to say it's on Cahuenga. It was right across from a place called Beauty in Essex, or kind of like right around there. It's just a little cafe. I'd been there before, and they have a salmon belly sandwich that's quite delightful. Hmm. But you went to a banh mi place that seems to be the talk of the office here.
Banh mi from Daniel's recommendation, which was pretty amazing. They got this Georgian flatbread, Georgia the country, right? So apparently you guys are sick of it sometimes.
We've had it quite a few times at this point, but it's a standard haunt, as it were.
So the way we can segue this is to talk about one of our earlier episodes. We did a two-part series on weird historical flexes with our pals, Jack and Miles from the Daily Zeitgeist.
Yep.
And Jack hipped us to one of the strangest Darwin facts we'd learned up to that point, which was...
Well, it was the fact that Darwin in college had been a member of this, like, fraternity that was all about eating exotic creatures, and he took that lust for murder and flesh, exotic fleshes, and applied it to his research, where when he was exploring the Galapagos and, you know, charting all of the different species that he encountered and, you know, that made up the great tapestry that is the human experience and life on Earth, he'd eat at least one of each of them.
Yeah.
Sometimes more. I think he consumed so many Galapagosian tortoises that he single-handedly was a big part of the reason they went endangered and then extinct. I don't know. I might be overstating the case there a little bit, but I'm pretty sure there's some truth to that.
Yeah. And so, again, as we say whenever Darwin comes up in conversation on or off the air, thanks for ruining that for us, Jack. Thanks for ruining that guy for us.
I always say, Darwin, I hardly knew him. See?
I think you should lean into it, man.
I was going to lean into it, man. It's like, this is me now.
I'm such an easy crowd today, man, because I'm at that stage where it's like my head is stuffed with cotton. I'm very addled. Everything seems surreal and hilarious and loaded with symbolism and double entendre.
Well, Daniel seems to think we're funny. We're getting some solid laughs out of him. It could just be the fact that we're literally like two men losing their minds in a fish tank, and he is the audience here.
Hey, this is just my kind of humor. Right,
it's a thing to behold.
Me.
Oh, good. I love it.
Okay, he thinks it's humor.
All
awesome.
Right, let's continue. With this today's Darwin story.
Today's Darwin story, yes. There's another thing that people may generally not know about Charles Darwin. Like many famous, historically influential individuals, he is the sum of more than one person's work. We stand on the shoulder of giants. And one
just one shoulder?
We stand on just the one shoulder. It's usually the left because, like regular-sized bipeds, you know, like 90% of giants are right-handed.
And also, one giant shoulder would be the equivalent of a set of shoulders for a regular-sized.
Many, many shoulders.
Biped, yeah.
So there is a person in the evolution of Darwin, which is a terrible choice of words on my part, there's a person in Darwin's past who is who plays a crucial and vital role in all of the work that Darwin went on to create. He's a person that many of us may not have heard of before. His name is very cool, by the way. It is John Edmonstone.
I love Edmonstone. I don't know why. You know why? I know why.
Why?
It makes me think of the Flintstones. Because everyone's last name in the Flintstone ended with stone.
Wait, everybody?
Nah, maybe not everybody.
Well, there's Betty and Barney Rubble. There we go. I got one. That's a construction rock related thing.
Anyway, it just makes me think of the Flintstones. That's why.
That's great. And I think Rubble. I think you're on to something with the rock themes. Anyway, John Edmonstone, not an inspiration for the Flintstones, as far as we know, but he was one of the sources of support and inspiration for Charles Darwin. John Edmonstone was from Guyana, South America, also the country where Jim Jones and his cult relocated.
Yeah, the Kool-Aid genocide.
Technically, it was Flavor-Aid.
That's right. He didn't even pop for the good stuff.
No, he didn't.
Guess it didn't really matter.
Not at that point.
No.
But that's a story for another day.
It took a dark turn.
Oh, this is going to take some turns. We suckered Daniel in here with our previous episode. That was a lot of fun, and now we're going into some disturbing stuff.
Are you talking about the one about luxury?
Luxury. John Edmonstone was formerly enslaved, and then he was manumitted. He was a freed slave from Guyana, and he was in Edinburgh teaching university students taxidermy. He lived literally down the street from where Charles Darwin and Charles's brother Erasmus, awesome name, lived.
Yeah, 37 Lothian Street, right there in Edinburgh. And he learned his trade, John did, from a man by the name of Charles Waterton, who is another assumingly competing naturalist to Darwin in the 1800s, early 1800s. Well, I guess not. Maybe it was a different time. He would have already attained these skills and then crossed paths with Darwin. So forget about my fake beef that I just made up between these all British naturalists. Clearly,
they have a Highlander
cage
thing
match kind
going
of situation.
On.
Yeah, they're very very intense dudes. But yeah, I mean, they kind of just became pals, right?
Yeah. So while Darwin is a student at Edinburgh, he approaches John Edmonstone and asks him, you know, Mr. Edmonstone, will you teach me to be a taxidermist? They would enter into this teacher-student relationship, and they would hang out, and they would have conversations, shoot the breeze, and John would tell Charles about the land of South America, about the continent, about the tropical rainforest, about Guyana. And historians believe that these conversations may have been the spark that fanned the flames of Charles Darwin's ambitions to explore the tropics.
I was going to make a forest fire reference there, but I think we already got there.
Okay.
I was going to say that fanned the flames of the forest fire in his mind.
I like the alliteration.
Yeah. We love alliteration here on Ridiculous.
Fanned the flames of the forest fire in his fancy.
Nice.
I don't know.
Of his fancy.
Of his fancy.
Boom.
Okay, we got there.
We did.
So we know that regardless of how we want to phrase it, the taxidermy skills that Darwin did provably learn from Edmund Stone were indispensable when he was later traveling, famously aboard the HMS Beagle in 1831. So let's talk a little bit about this man who has been so woefully ignored by by history, or at least the history we would learn in school. He was born into slavery in British Guiana in the late 1700s. In his early years, he was on a plantation in a region in present-day Guiana that was called Demerara.
That's right. And there were a lot of ties with Caribbean countries. So Guiana was kind of looked at as an extension, I guess, of the Caribbean. A lot of the political and cultural and ties historically to the Caribbean. So Charles Edmund Stone was a Scottish politician, the original Charles Edmund Stone, I guess, let's say, who owned this plantation where young John lived and worked. And in the early 1800s, we'll call him the Elder Charles, was visited by a man by the name of Charles Waterton, who would go on to not only become a renowned naturalist, but also the Elder Edmund Stone's son-in-law.
Yeah, and while they're interacting on this plantation, Charles Waterton takes John Edmund Stone sort of as his protege, right? He becomes a mentor, and he teaches Edmund Stone taxidermy. If you look at the contemporary reports, Charles Waterton says, "I taught him the proper way to stuff birds." And so John Edmund Stone and Charles Waterton would patrol, walk through the surrounding rainforest, and they would collect bird specimens. This was really a two-person job because, you know, most birds can fly, and as far as we know, most people cannot. I don't know why I made that such a point.
It's the lack of sleep, Ben.
It's probably the lack of sleep. No, but anyway, that statement is at least true. And so they had to go find these birds, and they wanted to find new specimens, unique specimens. And then once they captured them, killed them, they had to quickly preserve them because this is the jungle. It's very hot.
It's so crazy to think of the idea of field taxidermy, right? But that's absolutely what you had to do because it was so humid and hot that the bird carcasses would start to rot and decompose very, very quickly.
So what is field taxidermy? What do they actually do?
Yeah, they had to soak the carcasses in this mixture where the primary ingredient was mercury. And then, of course, they'd, pull out all their guts and stuff them with some stuff. What would be some of the stuff they might stuff them with, Ben? I think sawdust was popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably not other birds. The turducken is it's a different thing.
That's an abomination, Ben.
I've never had one. But yeah, their primary goal here is to, soak them, as you said, in that sublimate of mercury and preserve the outer shell. They don't really care about the stuffing other than what helps it appear lifelike. And during these expeditions, Edmund Stone gains a lot of knowledge about the biodiversity of South America, and Guyana in particular. But there's an important point we have to hit here. You can look back on stories like this and say, oh, these people were, despite the social hierarchies foisted upon them, actual friends. But it's tough to ascribe that to them because we have to remember this man was enslaved. He did not have the agency to consent or not consent to these expeditions. It wasn't until the Slave Trade Act of 1807 that things began to change for John Edmonston. The Slave Trade Act of 1807, this law from the British Empire that says the purchase or ownership of slaves is illegal within all the lands of the British Empire. Like a lot of laws concerning manumission, the law on paper doesn't always 100% reflect the law as it should be practiced or as it is practiced. So in 1807, Edmundston travels to Glasgow with the Scottish politician who owns the plantation, his namesake, Edmundston the Elder. And while he is in Scotland, he gains his freedom. You'll hear a couple conflicting accounts. Some folks say that it was 1817 when he gains his freedom, so he was still enslaved for 10 years in Scotland. It's interesting, but either way, by 1817, at the very least, he is a free man finally. And he says, I'm moving from Glasgow to Edinburgh. And that's, you know, and then he begins to live at the address you mentioned earlier, 37 Lothian Street. And it's just right down the street from University of Edinburgh.
That's right. And that's where he made the acquaintance of a pint-sized 16-year-old, Darwin, who had come to study at Edinburgh to study medicine. Like it was a generational thing in his family. His father had been a doctor and his grandfather, and he lived with his brother, as you said, the delightfully named Erasmus, on Lothian Street. And that was just a couple of doors down from John's house. So it was kind of just serendipitous that these two guys kind of became pals.
Yeah, and he did hire him as a tutor, essentially, a taxidermy tutor.
Because Darwin knew pretty quickly that a doctor he was not. He was more interested in exploring and adventures. And again, he'd already been kind of dreaming of some of those places that John would kind of really hip him to in South America and really make those dreams come alive in his mind.
Yes, exactly. Just so. And in Darwin's defense, we have to realize that, you know, even today, a lot of college students, we don't really know 100% what we want to do. It's a very common thing. And then furthermore, during surgery in this time, there was no anesthesia.
Mm-mm.
This reminds me of the story of Robert Liston. We were a little clickbaity with the title, but it is true that he did perform a surgery with a 300% fatality
rate. I was going to say 200%. I obviously don't understand how math works, because that still is a head scratcher to me.
Because he hit the guy hit the surgical assistant or a bystander.
He nicked an artery and it bled out, right?
Yeah.
Ugh. He swung wide on that one.
He swung wide because you had to work fast. There was no anesthesia. Anyway, Darwin says, this is not the life for me. And so he and John Edmonstone make an agreement where Darwin will pay John Edmonstone 1 guinea per lesson, and that after 40 daily hour-long sessions, his training in taxidermy will be considered complete. If we want to inflation calculate this to get a sense of the math.
Are we going to do it?
Yeah, yeah.
Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, beep, boop, doo, deep, boop, ding.
Perfect. 1 guinea or is replaced by the pound in 1816. But anyway, in 1825, 1 guinea was about $160 US.
Nice.
Today.
Not too shabby.
Right. It feels like he is paying for a college course at that point.
For sure. For sure. And that was when, he started talking about the lush tropical regions and all of the creatures and the vegetation that populated it there in South America. Where was it again? Demerara?
Yeah, the plantation.
That's right. And it really got Darwin thinking about a career in naturalism.
Right. And at this time, Guyana is making international headlines too, not just headlines in Darwin's mind. You see, at the time, Guyana has become the site of a slave rebellion, and this rebellion was ultimately unsuccessful and had been crushed a few months earlier. Compounding this, Charles Waterton had published a book about his expeditions to Guyana named, in a burst of creativity, Wanderings in South America. It's hugely popular. Everybody loves it. And Edmonstone's stories, along with Waterton's book, along with the international headlines about Guyana, very plausibly inspired Darwin to explore, to discover more things. And during this winter, when he's receiving his taxidermy training, he begins to think of his teacher, of John Edmonstone, more and more as not just a teacher, but a friend, you know, a mentor.
A real mentor, exactly.
And we have a letter that Darwin wrote to his sister about the course that Edmonstone taught him. And originally, he said, it has the recommendation of cheapness, if nothing else, as he only charges 1 guinea for an hour every day for 2 months. And then they eventually, as they become closer, later Darwin writes about John Edmonstone in his memoir. And then in this writing, Darwin says that Edmonstone is, quote, a very pleasant and intelligent man. I spent many hours in conversation at his side. of course, you know, we know that Darwin is still trying to resist his father saying, like, you will be a doctor. I was a doctor. We're a family of doctors. And that is why in 1831, at the age of 22, inspired by and educated by John Edmund Stone, Darwin gets a place on the HMS Beagle as they voyage to chart the South American coastline. And he gets, he secures this position, not as a doctor, not as a surgeon, but as a naturalist.
Yeah, just as he had wished. And all of those lessons in taxidermy were huge. His ability to do that in the field so quickly and efficiently were a massive help on this voyage and in helping him formulate his theory of evolution and the idea of natural selection. And he, when he was eating tortoises on the Galapagos Island, there's a really cool story here from history.co.uk, where we'll call it the finch story, right? He saw that there were differences between these birds, these finches on the island, and the big one had to do with the shape of their beak. If I may, Ben, I would like to read some intensely triggering descriptions of birds.
I was going to ask you, I'll go ahead and ask on air, are you sure you're okay?
It's
I just want to check in
it's good
with
for me.
You, all right?
It's going to help me.
All right, well, you're in okay? a safe spot, so let me know if anything goes sideways.
I'm going to get through it.
We can stop. Oh, sorry, Daniel. Noel, okay, you know about the bird thing?
I know about the bird thing.
Everybody knows about the bird thing.
Okay, you probably talked about it in Zeitgeist.
It's obvious just from the look on my face when you see a pigeon walk by. And yeah. My eyes light up in horror. Here we go. Here, I'm gonna make this happen. Some of the finches had broad, deep beaks, some elongated, and others small and stout. Ben, can you continue? I can't go on.
Yeah. So... I thought you did a good job.
Thanks, man.
So Darwin notices, as we said, specifically that some of the finches have one kind of beak and some have other kinds. Some finches have broad, deep beaks. Some have really long beaks and some have very small, very tough, stout beaks. And he says, you know what I think's happening here? You can differentiate the finches by their beaks and also by the islands upon which these finches reside. And each island has different sort of stuff for finches to eat. And so I believe that over time, advantageous traits that lead to certain types of beaks become more common in the breeding population. So if we have a finch population on an island with lots of seeds, the individual finches that have broad beaks that can help them crack open the hard coating of seeds will have a better chance of surviving and reproducing, and then they become more common, and ultimately they become the only kind of finch on that island.
That's right. It's like we were talking about with Katie Golden on Creature Feature when we were talking. I had asked the very stupid question of, you know, why. What was the advantage of the woodpecker being able to, you know, it's such a damaging adaptation to the creature to, like, basically essentially gives it brain damage over time.
Concussions,
but what's the edge? And the edge is obviously the other creatures can't get those bugs that are in that tree way up there that he has to dig, or, you know, the bird has to dig so deep for, and, you know, to such personal harm.
And... there is another influence that Edmund Stone had on Darwin. And this is not completely proven, but it's something that a lot of historians speculate about. They believe that it may have been Darwin's personal relationship with John Edmund Stone, along with the abolitionist beliefs of his grandfathers, of course, that contributed to his famous loathing and hatred of slavery. And that comes to us via Clifford B. Frith in his book, Charles Darwin's Life with Birds, His Complete Ornithology, which I promise you will never have to read.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for shielding me from the horrible, beady-eyed, weird, taloned, gangly, twitchy creatures.
All right. Now, at this point, you're just doing it to yourself.
You're probably right. So, I'm a glutton for punishment.
So we know that this personal relationship and his firsthand experience seeing the just gross atrocities of slavery had made him very much an abolitionist. And then they will also argue that his anti-slavery beliefs may have had a relationship to the formation of his theory of natural selection, because it traces all things that are ostensibly different, quote unquote, races or whatever, to a common ancestor. And that challenges the popular notion at that time that a certain type of person could be somehow considered inferior or superior.
Absolutely. And he really did see it firsthand with the bloody aftermath of some of the slave rebellions in South America.
And now, you know, we did it again. We did the thing that a lot of historians have done, which is we started dwelling on Charles Darwin instead of John Edmonstone. So let's give John Edmonstone his due. What happened to him? Do we know what happened after the taxidermy lessons were wrapped, after Darwin heads off?
Well, no, and that's sort of the impetus for the story, is that he was sort of an uncredited influence on Darwin, and the fact that we know anything about him and kind of help share his story, I think is pretty cool. What we do know about him comes directly from a very short little blurb in Darwin's own autobiography.
That's right. It's the moment where he recalls the conversations they had, right? And then this sets people off on a path to learn more about John Edmonstone. We know that after his interaction teaching Charles Darwin, he stays in Edinburgh. He moves in the 1830s to area South St. David Street. And if you look at, there were some real crackerjack researchers here. If you look at the Scottish Industrial and Natural History Museum register, which is later the Royal Scottish Museum, you see that they acquired a boa constrictor skin, a 15-foot boa constrictor, from a Mr. Edmonstone. And that seems likely to be John Edmonstone. And then there are a couple of other records relating to him, showing that the museum has purchased different specimens from him. But eventually, John Edmonstone began to receive his due. In 2009, a small plaque was mounted on Lothian Street, really close to Edmonstone's original home in Edinburgh. It commemorates his years of mentorship, his years as an educator. And, you know, it's a small gesture. It's better than nothing, but it's at least finally, as the University of Texas says, acknowledging Edmonstone's influence as historians continue to make efforts to learn more about his life. And here for now, our story draws to a close, or maybe let's call it a pause, because, you know, history is active. It's a conversation. People are still learning more stuff about John Edmonstone. And, you know, in the coming years, we might learn even more. And I have to ask, I'll be completely upfront and 100% honest here. I had not heard of John Edmonstone. Had you guys? Had you, Daniel?
Never.
No, I had neither. And unfortunately, as recently as 1978, some of the academic writing about Edmonstone and his work used some pretty racist language. Daniela Lee, who's a professor of biology at the University of Missouri, once wrote a column from Scientific America where she was quoted as saying, "The next time I teach evolutionary biology, I am definitely including Edmonstone in my lectures. I hope others do as well."
Well said. And I think it's a sentiment we can all get behind. This concludes today's episode, but not our show. We want to hear from you. Who are some other figures that you think mainstream historical discourse has neglected? And who do you think has been maybe overblown or presented with some sort of sanitized image? I was listening to our Columbus episode.
Ben, I got a question. Let's do it real quick. In the spirit of the Daily Zeitgeist and being here in the LA studios, let's do an overrated, historical overrated, underrated.
I feel like that's every episode.
Yeah. I guess you're kind of right.
Historically underrated, this is a hot take, but I think what we call the Black Plague or the Black Death has, the way it's taught to people, it's historically underrated. The statistics, the estimates about how many people died are terrifying. I think people are giving those their full due, but there are so many long-term effects, the consequences, ramifications of that massive outbreak, those three waves of outbreaks that we didn't know, we did not fully understand until recently, like the reason that some people have genetic inborn resistance to HIV. It's because of the Black Plague. That's just one example.
That was a very thoughtful and thoroughly researched answer. I'm going to do a hot take. Overrated.
Yeah.
George Washington, baby. Mic drop. Who needs him?
Oh, boy. All right. Well, let us know what you think, folks. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. Just type Ridiculous History into your internet connection of choice or your internet connection device of choice. I don't know, maybe meditate, maybe it'll just come to you. But if you want to take a shortcut, you can go to one of our favorite places online, our community page, Ridiculous Historians on Facebook, where you can hang out with our favorite part of the show, you and your fellow listeners.
Yeah, have a chat with Jonathan Strickland, the Quister. He's there like most of the time. He's probably there right now, lurking. You can also find us individually on social media. You can find me on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find me on Instagram getting kicked into and out of various countries, communities, and organizations at Ben Bolin in a burst of creativity. You can also find me on Twitter. I am at Ben Bolin HSW. Thanks as always to our third musketeer, super producer Casey Pegram. Again, big thanks to our guest super producer Daniel Goodman. And I like that sound effect from the last episode.
Just dreaming of Californication.
Do you think we'll get sued?
For saying the words Californication?
I don't know, man. I'm not.
It is a portmanteau. They probably can copyright that. Can you get sued for saying words?
Not yet.
What even are words anymore? But
not
seriously,
yet.
Daniel, thank you so much for having us and for being such an amazing host and super producer.
It is truly my pleasure.
This guy.
I can't even handle it.
So we have other people to thank.
We do. Thank you to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Of course, super producer Casey Pegram here in spirit. Christopher Hasiotis, also here in spirit. Jonathan Strickland, here as some sort of demonic presence, but here nonetheless.
And of course, thanks to our research associate, Gabe Luzier. Thank you to John Edmondstone. And, you know, despite his strange gustatory culinary inclinations, thanks to Charles Darwin.
Yeah, he seemed like he was okay.
Unless you're an animal.
A turducken?
Unless you're literally any animal he'd ever discovered.
Gross. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.